Hello, and welcome to An Aromatic Life. You're going to love this conversation today because it's all about stimulating your creative juices. My guest today was in the cocktail world as a mixologist for more than 10 years and then transitioned to creating perfumes. I love talking to creators in all kinds of different industries to learn from them how they approach their craft, to understand what inspires them to create in the way they do, and to hear how they find synergies across disciplines. Because let's be honest, many of us are multi-passionate people, right? Maybe we love photography, pottery, painting, I don't know, perfumery. Maybe you make drinks, brewing, beer, whatever your creative passions. This conversation aims to inspire you to think about things in new ways. You know, one of my favorite books, one that I highly recommend, is The Creative Act, A Way of Being by Rick Rubin. In the book, he says, creativity is not a rare ability. It's not difficult to access. Creativity is a fundamental aspect of being human. It's our birthright, and it's for all of us. So while my guest and I talk about cocktail mixing and perfumery, the creative concepts are universal, and they can be applied to all of us, because we are all creative and deserve to express that creativity. So let me tell you a little bit about my guest. Jackie Brunner began her blending practice in the world of mixology after graduating with a degree in fine art from the San Francisco Art Institute. She garnered acclaim around the world with original award-winning cocktails. It was the chance purchase of a perfumer's memoir from a small bookstore in Paris in 2012 that changed the trajectory of her career toward the ancient art of perfumery. Jackie found that the languages of mixology and perfumery were not so distant cousins, and her knack for creating delicious cocktails translated well into perfume making. She studied with master natural perfumer Mandy Aftel since 2013 and launched her brand DeCloca in 2022. Her Death & Co. perfume collaboration Los Angeles was nominated for an Institute for Art and Olfaction Award in 2023. Today, Jackie lives and works from her home in Berkeley, California. I hope this conversation inspires your creative juices. So grab your favorite cocktail, spritz a little perfume, and enjoy my conversation with Jackie Brunner. This is An Aromatic Life, the podcast that aims to shed light on our beautiful sense of smell and increase its profile in a culture dominated by sight and sound. My name is Frauke Gallia. I'm a certified aromatherapist and smell coach who spent over 20 years in and around the fragrance industry. What I know for sure after all these years is that our sense of smell is powerful, yet is so underappreciated. There's so much we can do to harness our sense of smell to be well. So join me as I explore this mesmerizing sense from all different angles and learn what it can do for you. Enjoy the show. Welcome you to An Aromatic Life, Jackie. So excited to have you here because you're doing such fun and interesting stuff. And I can't wait to talk to you about mixology and perfumery.
I'm really excited to be here. It's an honor. It's my first podcast and just really excited to share and talk.
Yeah, well, I have to say you're a badass in creativity. Sorry, it's just a fact.
Thank you.
I think one of the things that I was really drawn to when I said I'm going to have Jackie on because it's about mixology and perfumery, but it's really about creativity. And I think a lot of my listeners are creative people. And I think no matter what discipline you're in, whether you're doing something creative as a hobby or you're doing something as a professional, creativity is just in our bones, right? And I think we can learn from each other. So even if you have never mixed a drink in your life, or you don't drink, or you're not in perfumery, or you are, any of those things, I think it's going to be really fun and interesting to hear about your approach to creativity. So I'm looking forward to doing that.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think that we're all just playing with our senses, and this is a way that I've found really satisfies my spirit. So,
yeah, well, it comes through. Let me tell you that. But before we get started, I did want to ask you, what does the sense of smell mean to you?
Yeah, gosh, it's been such an important part of my life forever. It seems like I was that strange child who was smelling books or anything new that came in front of me, it didn't matter if it was something you were meant to smell or not, it was going to go in front of my nose. So I don't know if that's, if I'm part Neanderthal or closer to the animals or what's going on, but my sense of smell has always been really, really important and really key to the way I navigate the world. It's been just so intimately tied to my sense of comfort and safety. I can't tell you how many times I've been in a situation where a smell has been overpowering or offensive, even if it's a quote unquote good smell. I can't be around it. It's overwhelming and I have to escape that area. I think that's why the fires in California over the past 5, 6 years have been really hard because of the smoke and the sort of inescapableness of it. But yeah, smell is just, it's so important for me. I think about it now, but growing up or as a younger person, it was just who I am and how I navigate the world. But now, as I'm in my 40s now and I'm much more of a, in a reflective stage of life, I get to think about what that has meant and how that is different than some other people. When I experienced COVID for the first time, it was about a year ago, and I lost my sense of
You
smell.
did.
I did. I lost it completely for about 4 days, and it was terrifying, but also completely fascinating. I found it really interesting to experience taste without smell. The morning I knew that I didn't have my sense of smell, I could hear my son in the other room saying, "Oh, bacon." And I was like, "Bacon? They're cooking bacon? How can I not smell bacon?" And then I ate bacon later and I was like, "This is not good. This does not taste good if it doesn't have the smell." It was just like gristly and kind of like charred
Just salt,
tasting and
no?
very salty. Yeah, exactly. But it just wasn't an enjoyable situation without the smell. And so there was this interesting sort of like exploration of what the sense of smell is. And as it slowly came back, and because for me, I could always smell something from a mile away. I was the first person in the restaurant or the bar to know when a menu had caught on fire because I could smell it. I was the first one to smell it. That was back when they had ca real candles
I was
in
going to say,
bars and
how
restaurants.
often are menus catching on fire?
It used to happen a lot. It used to happen a lot
Wow,
in the early
good to know.
2000s. Yeah. Well, at least where I worked.
So many of my guests have lost their sense of smell, so they've all shared the same thing. It's very terrifying, and it's
Yeah,
lucky if you
it's,
get it back.
yes, exactly. I mean, it's interesting. I think from the beginning of the pandemic, that was my biggest fear. And I'm one of those people that kind of believes in manifestation. I was like, oh, once it happened, I was like, I made that happen. I was totally terrified of it, and I made it happen.
Oh
But it
man.
was interesting. I kind of looked at it as a way to explore the sense in a deeper level because people around me had always said, oh, you have this sort of superpower. And when you have it and you live it, you don't really understand it. But then to lose it and to slowly have it evolve back was really a fascinating process. And it gave me a sense of appreciation, but a sense of understanding about maybe how other people's noses are in the world. I kind of was joking. I was like, oh, when I was getting it back, but it wasn't, as great as it was, I'd be like, I think a lot of people, this is their baseline. This is how people smell. And it was really interesting as a perfumer to get, oh, well, certain subtle nuances aren't always definable, especially for the quote unquote normal nose. It's really interesting to explore.
No, I believe it. Let me ask you just to go back a little bit. I did some research on you. And did you grow up in
Uh-oh.
Hawaii? Is that correct?
I did, yeah. My family moved there when I was about 3 years old. My dad was in the Marine Corps, and we stayed there for about a year before we moved to Okinawa, Japan for a couple
Oh,
of
nice.
years, which
That's
I was r really little, but I have a lot of strong memories from being there. I think because it was just such a different culture and such an interesting place to be. And then we moved back to Hawaii when I was about six, and my parents got divorced, and my mom, brother, and sister, and I stayed in Hawaii. And I went to high school there. And once I graduated, I had to get off that island. But now, again, as I'm getting older, the last time I went back with my son, I was like, wow, I really understand why people live here. This is a really magical place
I mean, talk about
full of smells.
having, yes, I was going to say, talk about having sensory experiences when you're little and being connected through your nose. I can understand why that might be. Like on an island where you don't have
Just
smog,
the
and I
heat.
mean, maybe you do,
Yeah.
but not as much, or, it's not a cityscape as much.
To me, it's like the texture of the air because of the humidity. And I always noted it when we would go away, like on an airplane, and come back. And it was the first experience as I exited the airplane. Even in the jetway, you could feel that sort of, I always called it like flower soup. There was something sort of luscious about the humidity. And then you enter into it, and there's just plumeria trees right outside the gate. And then people being greeted with flower lei. And flowers are a really sacred part of the culture in Hawaii. And they're just everywhere. It's interesting to grow up amongst that and go away and come back. And yeah, I do believe it had a really important imprint on my sense of smell and on my childhood, for sure.
And on your work, I'm going to argue, the work that you do.
It's one of my like things that I'm working on for this year or next, is sort of my ode to my childhood, a perfume that captures for me what it was like to grow up in Hawaii. And there's a really amazing sandalwood producer on the Big Island that I actually went to go visit a couple years ago. They make sandalwood essential oil from a native varietal of sandalwood that they are planting and harvesting in a reforestation effort, because the Big Island of Hawaii was basically the natural native forests. Yeah. They were decimated for cattle ranching in the 1800s. And now that that's not really a thing anymore in Hawaii, it's a family-owned operation, and they are doing a reforestation process because the native sandalwood trees grow with native koa wood, and they have this sort of symbiotic relationship.
Right.
And it's a really cool thing that they're doing, but it's a really, really lovely essential oil, and that's kind of what I want to focus on in my perfume.
Nice. But so let me ask you also, can you remember when you were growing up there, was perfume even a part of your life? Can you remember your first perfume?
Well, it's so funny. I have to say, I have to come out and be completely honest, Ralph, that I'm not really a perfume person.
That's fair. That's totally fair.
I think it has to do with having a really sensitive nose. Like, my memories of perfume are really like watching my mom get ready to go out at night and then like being gassed by perfume
right.
when she spritzed and having to leave, which is really funny. But that being said, I think there were some things that I loved as a child, perfume-wise. I think there was this Body Shop fragrance.
Okay.
I don't remember its name. It was like something berry, maybe dewberry or muskberry. I don't remember. For me, it was a very kind of purple fragrance. And I guess this is part of my sense of smell kind of crosses senses a lot. And I think of colors or textures very much similarly with cocktails. I'd always think of something beyond just the way something smells or tastes. In my mind, it evokes a color or a texture.
Yes.
So there was that. I remember being gifted Lancome Poem, I think, for a Christmas, maybe when I was like 11 or 12. And
that's a classic.
And like thinking that I liked it, but anytime I would wear it, I would just be like, oh my God, I have to
get this off
of me. Yeah, it was just like, this is too close to my face.
Right.
So as I grew older, and when I did encounter perfume, I would spray it far away and then walk backwards through it so that it wouldn't be right in front of my nose while I was wearing it, which sounds nuts. But yeah, I mean, I think that's why I came to naturals. And that was the big draw for me, was naturals, because it didn't have that overwhelming, knock you in the face, choke you out effect. You know, they're much more intimate, they're much more ethereal, and they just don't hit you in the face the way that most commercial perfumes do.
Well, let's get into mixology, can we?
Yeah, please.
Yeah, I mean, I'm so intrigued by this area because it's new to me. I just find mixology really fascinating. To me, it seems, just what I've been researching about it and now getting into it a little bit, it seems like an art form to me. So I find it a really great creative outlet, which is why I want to explore it more myself. And I think when we talk about it here today, I want to make sure that anybody listening, even if you don't drink, I think what we're going to talk about here today can be completely relevant, and you can do this in a non-alcoholic way, right?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. I mentioned one of my biggest shifts in my life and career from the mixology, from the spirit world, was a sort of, how should we say, I lost interest in drinking and imbibing and wanted to start a family, and the lifestyle and the effects it had on my body were just not conducive to that new chapter in my life. And so I've shifted away from alcohol in a big way. I still drink occasionally, but yeah, I love non-alcoholic beverages. It's kind of like cooking, you know? It's just you're
Yes.
playing with flavor, you're playing with scent, you're playing with visuals
Flavor,
and texture.
everything. Yeah.
Absolutely. And the funnest thing about mixology or mixing drinks is that you get to create something and then you get to drink it and you get to have a good time. And there's this huge social aspect and, you know, this looseness that comes with it, which is a lot of fun. And I've found that even without the influences of alcohol, even if you spend the time to create the ritual of crafting a drink, even if it's non-alcoholic, there's something really special about that ritual, about taking the time to put something together. And that even if it's not alcoholic, there's this sense of excitement or frisson that you get from creating it and sharing it with others. So it's really fun and totally accessible for everybody.
Yeah, it's great. Tell me, like, how did it even come about?
Oh, it's such a long ago story. It's so funny. It's funny to me that people are like, I'm just getting into mixology or
Know,
cocktails
sorry.
because I'm so like, oh man, that was so many years ago. So I started, like many people who went to fine art school, I started off in the hospitality industry.
Okay.
So yeah, I graduated from art school in San Francisco in 2005. And at that point, I was working as a cocktail waitress at a restaurant in the city. And a bar in the city called Rye had opened up, and it was my local bar that I would go into. And on their menu one night, I noticed that they had cocktail competition coming up, and it put the date, and it was for tequila. And at this point in my life, I was like, well, what do you make with tequila besides margaritas and tequila sunrise? I had no idea. I was 22 years old. My experience with alcohol at this point was beers and lemon drops. Maybe a cosmopolitan, but really, I didn't know about cocktail culture. And it was really the beginning of this renaissance of cocktail culture. It was in the early 2000s when this started to kind of happen. I even remember as a cocktail waitress thinking that Campari was like a really sexy thing and that I wanted to drink Campari, but I couldn't handle the taste of it. But I trained myself to be able to drink Campari by mixing it with orange juice because then it tastes like grapefruit juice.
There you
And
go.
it's really delicious and super sweet.
Yeah, why not?
And yeah, exactly. So anyway, so back to Rye. I knew the owners. I was like, oh, well, can I enter the cocktail competition? I'm a very competitive person. I don't know why I was compelled to ask. I'm not even a bartender at this point. And my friends Greg and John, who own the bar, said, yeah, sure. Come on, join the fun. I was like, okay. And so my boyfriend at the time had a cookbook, a Rick Bayless cookbook.
Okay.
And I was flipping through it. You know, he's a very famous Chicago-based Mexican cuisine chef.
Yes.
And there was a photograph of a fruit vendor in Mexico who had a mango and it was sliced like a flower and it had chili, salt, and lime on it. And I was like, oh, that's drink inspiration right there. And so I worked on a cocktail that had tequila, lime, triple sec, mango puree, and a splash of Campari.
Got to put that one in. Yes.
Gotta put that in. And then I did this chili, salt, and lime rim. And the manager at the restaurant that I worked at the time really helped me out, Stephen Oliver. Shout out to him. He helped guide me and showed me how to make the drink. And like we put it together. And I went and I competed against 10 male bartenders who'd been doing it for years. And
Wow.
I ended up winning the competition.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you. And it was really
Amazing.
exciting. I was blown away and I really didn't know what I was doing technique-wise or like style. I just was making a drink and serving it. And I won a membership to the United States Bartenders Guild, which is a guild that's been around since I think the 70s or 80s, but was having this sort of revival with the craft cocktail movement. And they had monthly meetings that were sponsored by different spirit brands, and it was a presentation and like a lunch and cocktails. So it was free lunch, education, free cocktails. As a 22-year-old, I was like, yes, please,
Yes,
sign me up. And I was hooked. I was absolutely hooked. I was fascinated by it. I was very interested. I was already interested in wine at that point because my boyfriend at the time was a sommelier. And yeah, so the spirit world just was opened up to me and I was hooked. I absolutely loved it. I ended up competing in many more cocktail competitions. I got to compete in Singapore and in Bordeaux, France. And
How great is that? And you won a lot of these. competition.
Yeah, which was really cool.
So great.
So, yeah, it was great. And then I had some gigs as a bar manager for, I worked for Elizabeth Faulkner. I don't know if you remember. She had Citizen Cake in San Francisco. It was kind
Yes,
of a
yes.
famous restaurant. She opened a place called Orson, and I did the opening cocktail menu for her
Nice.
and very quickly learned that management was not my favorite thing. But coming up with cocktail lists was. I really loved that creative process. And then for a while, I worked at a really amazing bar called Heaven's Dog, which these are all places that don't exist anymore. But that was such a great experience because it was a Charles Fawn restaurant. And it was really my favorite thing, working behind the bar at a restaurant where people would come and sit and spend time with me. And we'd have this interaction where they would tell me about what they were in the mood for, what they usually like to drink, or where they had just been. And I would divine a cocktail for them. You know, I would come up with something because we had this option on the menu called Freedom from Choice. The freedom from choice process was this like really fun way for me to play with my intuition and conversation skills. And it was so rewarding because people would be like, oh, this is the best cocktail I've ever had. Like, how did you know this is exactly what I wanted? So it was so great for my ego. It's so great for this sort of immediate response, like this immediate creative response. Like I create something and get this reaction. And it was just really fun. Really great to create those experiences and create cocktails for people. And like my favorite part about perfume making right now is I've done some work with two different companies to co-create with them perfumes. And what I really want to move towards is bespoke perfumes. So we're working one-on-one with people and creating something that is unique for them. That really excites
That's exciting. Yeah. I was just going to ask
me.
you if it's the creative process itself or getting the reaction from the people afterwards, but you kind of answered that for me.
Ooh,
It
good
sounds like
question.
it's probably a tie, I'm guessing, because you seem to be somebody who really
Probably
loves the
both.
creative process just as much as
Yeah.
the outcome. Yeah.
I definitely have to just make. It's part of my being. You know, I just have to be creating something. I have a lot of hobbies, a lot of things I like to do. Making jewelry is one of them, perfume making. I'm getting into sort of like more spiritual creativity lately. I do tarot card readings and I'm studying astrology and like
Good.
exploring my full repertoire of witchy skills is how I describe
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
I thought one of the things we could do for people who obviously, I don't know how many people who are listening are actually mixologists. So for those of us who aren't, I thought we could start at the beginning and kind of, could you share what the building blocks are? You know, I come at it from the perspective of perfumery because that's what I know, but I imagine when you're mixing a cocktail, are there building blocks there as well or not so much?
Yeah, definitely. I guess we could look at the original cocktail or what cocktail historians agree is the original cocktail, and that is the old-fashioned cocktail,
Yes.
which is a very simple mix of spirit, sugar, water, and bitters. And this was basically the first way that people took raw spirit and said, you know, this isn't the most delicious thing on its own. What can we do? What can we do to help this medicine go down a little better? And of course, adding sugar does a lot for flavor, but also viscosity. And then bitters. Bitters are used kind of like the spice rack in cooking. You think of it as sort of a salt and pepper addition. It goes in very small amounts, but it has a very strong impact. I think of it for perfume making, like certain animalic accessory notes. Like I would think of ambergris or small dashes of very strong things, if
Right,
that makes any sense.
accents to kind
Yeah,
of
little
bring
accents.
me the flavor or the cocktail in this case in a certain direction, perhaps, right?
Exactly. And it's amazing nowadays, there's hundreds, probably thousands of flavors of bitters. When I started as a bartender, there was one. two. It was just Angostura and Peychaud's bitters, and that was it. And then someone launched an orange bitters, and people were like, oh. But now you can go to the fancy cocktail liquor store, and it's just mind-blowing.
Yes.
The amount of choice. It's really fun. Like, wow, gosh, the palette you have to play with. So if you could think back to the old-fashioned cocktail and that sort of basic spirit, sugar, waters, bitters, you have a basic backbone of a spirit forward cocktail. And so there's two, maybe like I would say three categories of cocktail that I think of. There's spirit forward, where there's no juice added. And it's like a Manhattan or a martini or an old fashioned where it's just booze. And then there's sour drinks. So things that have citrus in them that are shaken. And then for me, I think of spritzy drinks, so like a low ABV kind of aperitif style drink. Now, those are kind of my three main categories when I divide them up in my head. But they're really just subtle variations on each other, right? So you can take an old fashioned and you can add lemon juice and you kind of get a whiskey sour, right? If you're doing a whiskey old fashioned. And then you can substitute the whiskey for, you know, a wine aperitif like Lillet, and you can add some bubbly water and now you've got a spritz. So there's really just a lot of different ways that you can play with the different parts, taking them in and out. But ultimately, the end goal is you want balance. I think a lot of people, when they approach cocktails, they get confused about sweetness, because I think historically, cocktails have lacked fresh acidity. I think one of the biggest problems is that people used bottled sweet and sour mix for a really long time. So you just get overly sweet, insipid cocktails that don't have balance and aren't, I mean, they're probably tasty to some degree, but for me, it's like, ugh, I don't want to drink that. So when you're using fresh citrus, you get this great balance. So I had a lot of people come in and say, I want this, but I don't want any sugar in it. And I was like, that's not true. You don't want no sugar in this, trust me. And so I would make them a regular balanced good cocktail and they'd be like, this is perfect. This is amazing. What did you do? And I'm like, well, I just used fresh lemon juice and made sure to balance it with the sugar so that it creates harmony. And that's really, I think, what a lot of crafts attempt to do, right? Kind of the difference between art and craft in my mind is that the goal really is for harmony and balance. Whereas I think art, you know, your goals can be different. They can be a little more provocative or pointed in different ways.
So let me ask you then, what are some of your favorite ingredients that you have worked with? What are some fun ones? What are the ones, if you could only have a couple base ones, you know, obviously you need more than just a couple, but what do you like to work with?
It's really important to have like a solid back bar of a few base ingredients. That way you always have something to work with. You know, it's really important to have a nice London style dry gin on your back bar. I really like to Beefeater or Tanqueray, really classic old school brands. There's also really great, amazing new American style gins. But if you want to start from the beginning and start from the basics, it's really good to work with the original spirit brands. So that way you can build.
Yes.
A lot of the new American gins have like unique flavors and ingredients that make them interesting and fun. It's like an intermediate level because it challenges you because, oh, this is not a typical ingredient gin. So a great London style dry gin is good. A really nice clean vodka, because you're going to have vodka drinkers, even though people talk about it and kind of like, oh, it's the tofu of spirits. But, you know, tofu is delicious and it's important to use sometimes. Let's see what else. Oh, gosh. It's so hard too, because if you're just picking one from each category, because like rum is a huge category.
Sure.
Stylistically, they vary and they differ. So if you're making tiki cocktails, you're going to need a few different style of rums. But if you just want a nice, easy sipping, but also mixable rum, I really love this rum from Haiti called Rum Barbancourt. It makes a really killer daiquiri, which I think has a bad connotation to it. A daiquiri in its most simple original form is just rum, sugar, and fresh lime juice. Right. And it is transcendent. If you have proper rum and fresh lime juice, it's a really amazing cocktail.
You know, vodka is something that's pretty neutral. I'm thinking if you use something like that, then you can use other ingredients that shine more, and vodka just becomes the base for holding all those other beautiful ingredients. Or if you want the rum, if you want that to be the star more, and everything else just helps it to be more harmonious. Is that a good way of looking at it, would you say?
Yeah, when you're starting, it's important to keep it simple. You know, start with the basics. especially if you want to learn how to create. It's really the best thing to do. I know that for me personally, the same thing happened when I started making cocktails as when I started making perfume, is that I got really excited about the ingredients. I got really excited about all the different liqueurs, all the amaros, yes, all the different spirits. As same way I got excited about all the different absolutes and the concretes and the essentials. And I wanted to put everything in a drink and I wanted to put everything in a perfume. And you know what happens when you put everything in a drink and then you put everything in a perfume when you don't know what you're doing? You make mud.
Exactly.
But I'll tell you what, making mud is one of the best ways to learn how to do something, because the more you mix things, the more you create scent and taste memories. And that's really all that this is. When you start these types of things that require a big cache of memory, it really requires tasting and smelling things. It's the same thing if you want to become a sommelier, if you want to learn about wine, if you want to learn about spirits, if you want to learn about perfumes,
coffee,
anything,
tea,
coffee, tea, beer, everything. It requires tasting over and over again. And I do recommend that with spirits and wine. You absolutely have to spit. That is the way to do it. Otherwise, you're not going to remember things. You take notes and you think about how it tastes and smells to you, because ultimately these are the most subjective things. You know, like one thing that smells great or tastes great to me is going to taste horrible and smell awful to you. And that's kind of the fun thing about it. The way to, like, I enjoy the challenge of taking funky or challenging ingredients and making them into something that people like or enjoy.
Like you're wrangling it in or something. You're taking something that's
yeah, I'm like, yeah. I like the challenge. And I think it's part of my competitive nature to say, like, oh, you don't like that? Let me show you how you will like it. That was always my favorite. One of my favorite things when I was behind the bar, people all the time, I don't like gin. I don't like tequila. I'm like, okay, well. Challenge accepted. And I changed a lot of minds. I changed a lot of palates. And that was fun. That was fun. Like, how fun to open up a whole new category of something to someone. But yeah, it's just it's a good reminder to always keep your heart and your palate open to new experiences. And
yeah,
you know,
that's totally true. And I'm thinking just about the non-alcoholic piece of it. There's so many options there now, too. I mean, literally, that market must have exploded.
And not just juices, sodas, waters. There's now a whole market for non-alcoholic spirits.
Yes.
People are making things that are directed to the bar world. And it's just phenomenal. It's really fun. It's super exciting. There's a whole kaleidoscope of possibility now that didn't exist before. And I'm just really excited for that evolution in our industry because, it was getting a little hedonistic there for a while. The Bacchanal was getting a little wild and it needed a little bit of balance. And it's exciting to see that that has blossomed and filled a much needed space. I have a really good friend who used to work on Saint Germain elderflower liqueur, which was when that came out, I was just like, oh my God, this is game changing as an ingredient. And she now has a business called Maison Wellness, and she's based out of London. And all she does is focus on non-alcoholic beverages. Oh, and she has like a whole following on Instagram. And it's really exciting to see that there's something for everyone. It's being elevated. It's not just being called a mocktail anymore because, you know, it has respect. It's been given as much thought and effort as the other cocktails on the menu. It just doesn't have alcohol in it. And there's nothing lesser about it, you know?
I also want to ask you about the aesthetic part of it. So on the one hand, when you're looking at the cocktail, you know, you've got the color, you've got the garnish, you've got the glass. That's part of the experience. And then when you drink it, you have the texture too of the experience and the balance and what you're talking about. Can you give some insights there a little bit, how you approach that? What are different ways you can play with that? Because texture is huge, I think, and color as well.
Texture and color are huge. It's interesting. I just did a cocktail event on Saturday, which is super rare for me anymore, but my son's elementary school fundraiser was this weekend, and I volunteered to the PTA to offer my skills of mixology and bartending. And I was inspired by our school colors, which are purple and green. Okay. And our mascot is the dragon. And so that was my inspiration. I made a purple dragon and a green dragon. And it was really fun to like ideate on the theory of color and how to get the color in the drink, but then also how to translate the idea of the color in the flavor and the aroma. And so the green drink I use this amazing green juice from a local Berkeley restaurant called Fava. They make this green juice that's fresh lime, cucumber, parsley, and spinach.
Ooh.
And it's vibrant and bright and super sour. It's not sweet at all. And I mix that with tequila, a little bit of mezcal, Shiro, which is this amazing aloe liqueur. It's a California spirit that's been around for about 10 years. And it's, how to describe it? It's like if spa water was a lightly sweet liqueur.
Mm-hmm.
It's fantastic. It's got lemon and mint and muskmelon. So it has this sort of spa characteristic to it. Oh, and pineapple gum syrup from my friends at Small Hand Foods, who make these amazing cocktail ingredients that are made from real food. So a lot of syrups that you see on the market are flavored and colored, but these are actually made from real ingredients, which make such a difference in your drinks. So you had the pineapple and the tequila, and there was this like tropical element, and then the green came through, and everything was like really fresh and bright. And so that sort of texture to me was really speaking to the color of green. And the pineapple gum syrup also gave it kind of a nice viscosity. So when the drink was shaken, there was a little bit of kind of a foam on top. So it was really pretty, I thought. So that was my green drink. And then the purple drink I had fun with. Have you ever heard of butterfly pea flower?
Never.
Butterfly. Okay, so butterfly pea flower is this flower. It doesn't have a scent or a flavor, but it makes things blue, like electric blue.
Wow.
And yeah, so I infused vodka with the butterfly pea flowers. And when you add anything acidic to it, so citrus juice or like wine, it changes it to purple. And it's like this kind of magical ingredient. It's really fun to play with. So you can make a syrup out of it. You can infuse it into spirits. But it's a really fun way to play with the color blue. And then, of course, to make purple. And then I used a blackberry liqueur from Giffard and some orgeat, which is an almond syrup, also from Small Hand Foods, to add sort of like a creamy nuttiness, viscosity, and texture. And fresh lemon juice and soda water. And yeah, they were like really brightly colored and it was so fun. People just were losing their minds because it's really, it's one thing I think nowadays, the bright colored cocktails, I think got a bad rep because they were like just made with artificial colors and artificial flavors. And to make a fresh cocktail that utilizes the idea of balance and harmony and fresh ingredients and still has a really impactful color is still kind of a wow experience, which is a lot of fun.
Oh, that sounds amazing. Do you have any other memorable cocktails that you've created that are really unique? Something that you've done in the past?
Oh gosh, it's funny. I've played a lot. And it's funny to think about in retrospect now that I do what I do now, but I was kind of known for making light floral cocktails.
Okay.
So very sort of like cocktails with floral ingredients that were subtle and not super like in your face. I always had a really hard time with whiskeys because they were just too big, you know, and too overwhelming, kind of like my commercial perfume memories of past. The same way I feel about oaky California Chardonnay. It's just not my jam. It's just one note. It's kind of over the top. I feel that way about American whiskey. But yeah, so one of my favorite drinks I used to do was a really, and actually my husband likes to tell the story about how I was working in a bar that no longer exists. It was called Zinnia, named after a flower, funny enough. So my cocktail menu was all kind of flower inspired. And I had a cocktail on the menu called the Fleur du Monde, flower of the world. And it was a tequila cocktail, a Blanco tequila cocktail with a Spätlese Riesling, so a slightly sweet white wine, and a ginger liqueur. I think there was a bitters in it, and it was a stirred drink. And Felix, my husband now, when he came into the bar, he had probably three of them. And was totally, I think I put him under a spell. I think
there
that's how it happened. That's how I caught my husband.
I love it. That's great. Do you know, I have to tell you, when I was working at a fragrance house, we would have these creative sensoriums. And because Furnish is both a fragrance and flavor house, we would bring things in from the flavor area and have people just enjoy them through perfumery and vice versa. So Furnish made the Dolce & Gabbana Light Blue fragrance, which is well known. And they created a drink out of it. So you were actually drinking that perfume. And it was the most amazing experience I ever had. I was like, wow, so cool to just this thing that was pretty common, the light blue Dolce & Gabbana. And then suddenly you're drinking it and your mind just shifts like, wait, this is something you can also drink. So I love that connection. And I know that's what you do. You know, you create perfumes based on things that people have made in drinks as well. So I just wanted to share that. So let's move on to perfumery then. You were this mixologist for how many years would you say, like 10 years or something?
Yeah, a little over a decade. I started in hospitality and bartending and then bar management. And in 2010, I started working for a global spirit company called William Grant & Sons as a brand ambassador, which was really fun for that stage in my life. Mm-hmm. And then I got into like the more sales and marketing side of things. I worked for a small importer called Back Bar Project. We were bringing in really interesting spirits into the US, some really amazing artisanal mezcals, which was part of my inspiration for one of my perfumes, Oaxaca. Mm-hmm. So I did that for a really long time. And then in 2013, this is still kind of at the height of my career in the bar world and spirits, I was in Paris and I bought a book called Diary of a Nose by Jean-Claude Elena, who's the master perfumer for Hermès. And I kind of just bought it on a whim at this really cute English bookstore in Paris. And I read it, and it's basically his creative diary of creating perfumes for Hermès in 1 year. And I was just really struck with the language he used to talk about his creative process, and the way that he thought about scent and the way he thought about creating perfume was so similar to the way that I think about making drinks and making cocktails. And I was like, huh, I wonder if I can take this language that I know so well and translate it into this other medium. Because at the end of the day, it is both mixing with alcohol, you know, it's very similar. And so I was intrigued, but then I was like, well, I don't really like perfume. But I also remembered about Mandy Aftel, who is just the most amazing perfumer. She's the OG natural perfumer. Yeah. And I knew about her because when I worked at a restaurant in San Francisco in the early 2000s, she had written a book with Daniel Patterson, who was the chef of the restaurant I was working at. And so she had come in and I knew the book, the cookbook, because we sold it. And it was on my radar. And I was like, oh, this is so fascinating. She makes these chef's essences. And oh, this is really interesting. And so it was logged in the back of my mind. And so when I picked up that book, I was like, huh, well, I'm thinking about Mandy now. And so then I got her books and read her books and saw that she taught courses, and it was in my backyard. I was living in San Francisco at the time. And I was like, huh, let's check this out. Let's try it. So yeah, I started to make this really big pivot, and I took my first in-studio training class with Mandy. She doesn't do those anymore, but that was in 2013. I was very lucky to do that twice. It's really, really cool. Because perfumery, I mean, for me at least, is very kind of an isolated creative process.
It is.
Which I really kind of love, not going to lie. I really like being holed up in my attic, making things all day. And it's so opposite from what I used to do. It's really interesting. You know, I had such an outward facing career in the booze world, and I was out all the time and entertaining and doing events. And in retrospect, I don't think I really liked it.
You're more of an introvert is what you are.
I'm much more of an introvert. It's really funny. So I've really found this great, intimate, creative space. But it's really nice to do the classes with Mandy or the events that you've organized, Frauke, for the Bay Area smelly community. It's really fun every once in a while to get out and just to have a sense of community and connect with people who are like-minded and are also get really nerdy and geeky and excited about these types of things.
But tell me then, when you first, was your instinct to just come at it from the point of view of a mixologist? Is that like the first place you went, or did you have an open mind and said, let me just see what she's telling me? Like, how did you approach it at the beginning versus how you might be doing it now?
That's interesting. I definitely just sort of was excited by the ingredients, kind of the way I was with the spirits. And Mandy's very much that way. She's very excited about the ingredients, about the essences and how special they are. And I could totally relate. I was like, yes, I'm jazzed on that. But then when it came to like ideation for mixing things, it was definitely inspired by where I came from as far as the food and drink world and my travel experiences. And it's interesting, in I just did a class with her last month. I hadn't done it for a couple of years. And she always has an assignment where we do like a
a classic style of perfume. And I've never studied perfume in that way, like a fougère or a chypre or, you know, these kind of classic perfume formulas, which is a really interesting challenge for me because I don't really know about them. I don't have a lot of experience with them. I don't think that way. I think about, oh, this cocktail or this dish, or when I was in Italy and I, you know, there was lemons growing next to the rosemary. And that's my inspiration, not this sort of historical perfume thing. So it's interesting. It's an interesting challenge to think about, like, how I think about my creative process and what inspires me to create perfumes.
Did you have to wrangle the ingredients in a different way?
It's much easier, I think. I mean, there's a lot of forgiveness with one of the main ingredients in cocktails, and that is sugar. Sugar helps everything taste better. So, like, if you can get balance with cocktails, sometimes flavor doesn't matter as much. If you can hit the balance between the sweet and the sour, or the, like, strong and the and the sweet, flavors do matter, don't get me wrong, but it's much more forgiving. And I think with perfume, it's so laid bare. You know, you're just mixing either raw ingredients together or you're mixing them into pure alcohol. It's a little easier to mess things up, I would say that.
Well, and also when you're mixing a cocktail, you're going to be drinking it right away. You're not going to let it sit for a month at a time. Whereas in perfumery, you have maceration too, and it evolves over time. That's also an interesting facet. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's interesting, you know, people are doing wild, amazing, crazy things that I didn't even know were possible when I started. But if you think about, there are people that are putting cocktails in barrels and aging them. And so
I didn't know that.
Barrel aged cocktails, totally a thing, or at least it was a thing. I don't know if it still is a thing. Barrel aged cocktails, experimenting with aging in glass, all sorts of things. I think there are so many people that are doing it now, and they're doing it so much better than I did. And they're really, like, exploring and taking it to the next level. So it's a really fun world to follow along. And what's more fun than going to a cool, fun bar and having drinks and getting to experience the creativity of these bar people? It's really fun.
Tell me, what are some of the key principles that you take from mixology that you now apply to your perfumery creation? Is there something that you have taken with you that you continue to take with you?
Yeah. You know, one of the greatest tips of advice I got when I was a young bartender was to keep it simple, stupid.
Yeah.
K-I-S-S, keep it simple, stupid. And especially with naturals, as opposed to what I assume when what I know about making perfume with, like, isolated molecules and synthetic ingredients is that, you know, you have one note, right? And you can use hundreds and hundreds of those tiny notes to craft a perfume. With naturals, you already have hundreds of notes inside a single ingredient.
That's right.
And so when you're working with those, it's really important to remember that, and to remember that you already have the Mona Lisa that you're working with in some of these ingredients. And so you have to really respect each individual ingredient and remember that it is worthy of a platform in its own right. And to just not mess it up.
Yeah,
you know, have more respect and reverence for the ingredients. I think that's actually a really interesting point, a little connection I just made in my mind about the spirit world and perfume. And I think that perfume is starting to get there. But with the spirit world, it was really important and not so there in the beginning when I started, was this idea of transparency and understanding of the origin of things and the way things are made and what they're made with. Because spirits aren't required to list ingredients, and actually a lot of spirits contain ingredients, even when you think, oh, well, it's just distilled grape or distilled barley, but that's not actually true. A lot of tequila, a lot of whiskey, they have ingredients that are added to them to create consistency, and that's the problem in my book. And so when I entered the perfume world, I was really curious, and I feel like it's kind of the next frontier for me in my process, is getting to understand where things are coming from, how they're produced, how the people are treated who are making them, what the chemicals are used in the extraction process, all these questions that I don't think people were able to ask 10 years ago, that I think more and more people are asking and wanting to know and understand where things are coming from. And I think that feels like the next frontier for me, because it's important. How do you treat something reverently? Well, you understand it and you understand where it comes from and you're curious about that and you want to know, right?
Yeah.
You want to know.
No, I couldn't agree more. Have you also encountered any unexpected synergies between perfume ingredients and cocktail ingredients? in terms of how they behave or blend? Or?
I think about it a lot, especially when I'm batching up or doing a larger run of something. I did a lot of events when I worked in the booze world, and I had to batch a lot of cocktails, which meant I would make vats of hundreds of drinks at a time. And there were certain ingredients that if you added it to a batch with the same proportion that you would for an individual cocktail, it would completely ruin the whole batch. There was something about it that it bloomed in a larger proportion. I don't know why or how scientifically if that's a thing, but it was like a sensory experience that was real. Mm-hmm. It's very similar with a lot of the stronger aromatic ingredients. So like guaiacol or pine tar, which is really smoky. There's certain super tenacious ingredients, lemongrass, that are very, very strong and you use in small amounts carefully. And I also think about it when I'm doing a larger batch of them, even though I measure and weigh and figure out the appropriate amount, I don't add the whole amount at once. And that was something I learned from batching with cocktails with those strong ingredients. So it's interesting that it's very similar because they certainly bloom in different ways than other ingredients.
Yeah.
I also think about balance a lot. You know, it's funny to think of smells having, like there are certain smells that are kind of sour in smell, and not just the citruses, but there's certain sour ingredients, which are nice to think of. I think of those as like using an acid in a cocktail. And there's other things that I think of as just like strength and then subtle ingredients as well. And it's like creating a dish, you know, cooking at home or a drink. Anything where you're blending different things together. And Mandy talks about this a lot, the theory of burying and locking ingredients, you know, those things that come together really nice or those things that hide other things or, you know, you have to think about all these things. But again, like really the best way to think about those things is to play with them and experiment and try them and do them over and over again and make mistakes and fail and make really stinky things because that's how you learn. As much of a scent memory as I have of things, I can think about how something will go together. But until I actually put it together, I don't know exactly.
Yeah.
That's kind of the fun part of it, right?
It's like the experience of it. It's really the experience of it as opposed to the theoretical.
Right. And I get stuck in my head a lot. I do a lot of ideation in my mind in like liminal space. And I did that with cocktails. I do that with perfumes. It's another similarity, I guess. But yeah, I get stuck in the idea of what something should be, especially if I have a very specific idea of like Oaxaca. I really struggled with one of my perfumes. It's the one I've made the most iterations of because I had a really specific idea of things that you find in Oaxaca, right? Ingredients that should be there. And when I was putting them together, I was like, it doesn't work in the perfume. And I had to let go of the egoistic idea of what was in my head and actually just really get into the material and the sensory and to kind of like the magician card in the tarot. I don't know if you know tarot at all, but the magician takes what is above, like ideas and thought and inspiration, and makes it material. It makes it into matter, as above, so below, right? And the magician has tools to do this, and he uses them, she uses them, they use them to create, to take ideas, which that's all anything is in this world, right? Yeah. Everything that we have in this world is somebody's imagination, somebody's idea, somebody thought of this and created it. And it's material now because it's been manifest. But before, it was just in someone's mind. It was just this imaginary experience. And so it's really fun to use the tools and the craft of making and creating and experimenting and smelling over and over and over again to make something that speaks to someone's soul, to speak to spirit.
Yeah. I also find that I learn a lot from the ingredients themselves. Sometimes they tell me things as opposed to just me thinking, oh, this is what I think it is. No, the ingredients are telling you what they are. It's the other way around.
They have their own spirit. Yeah. They have their own spirit. Absolutely. They absolutely do.
Well, let's get into your perfume line, Dakloka. Tell me what Dakloka is. Tell everybody what Dakloka means.
Yeah, this is so interesting. I named my brand something kind of witchy and spiritual before I even had a spiritual awakening. So it must have been meant to be. But Dakloka is a Swedish word. It means the wise ones. And it's what the Swedish people call their folk healers, their white witches, Ardikloka, the wise people. And I wanted it to speak to the ancient tradition of aromatic ingredients being used to connect with spirit and to connect to the other world, to connect to more than what is in this material realm. I've kind of always thought of spirits in that way, alcoholic spirits and perfume ingredients. You know, alcohol to imbibe was discovered because people were distilling aromatic ingredients for perfume.
Yeah.
So there is this through line, right? That perfume is kind of a predecessor to alcoholic ingredients or distilled spirits. Sorry, there was definitely alcohol before then. People had wine and beer for sure. But there's this interesting connection there. And yeah, when I started making perfume, I just had this confidence. It's like, I'm going to make a brand. I'm going to do something and it's going to be really good. And I was really excited. It took me a decade to do it, but
that's honest. Like it takes that long to really feel like you're ready to put something out into the world.
So I launched in January of 2022. And yeah, I launched with two perfumes, Oaxaca and Sun Gold. Mm-hmm. They're kind of day and night for me. They're very, very different.
Yes.
Sun Gold is bright and sunny and citrusy and vibrant. It's inspired by a cocktail, actually not one of my own, but a cocktail called the Sun Gold Zinger that was invented by a bartender in San Francisco named Carlos Ituria at a bar called Range. It's no longer there. But it was very simple, a gin drink with muddled Sun Gold tomatoes, fresh lemon, I think agave nectar, and maybe soda water. Don't quote me. And just this sort of like mix of savory from the tomato with the sweetness and the citrus. So like that flavor profile was an inspiration. But then the other thing that I was inspired by, which is kind of a weird thing that perfumers talk about, oh, I was inspired by this, like, you know, shade of green. This is that for me. Sun Gold for me is this experience of sunlight after or right before a storm when the sky is really, really dark gray, but there's golden sunlight coming in. Yeah. And it's my favorite kind of light. It's just like, to me, it's just like really exciting and refreshing. And there's something really pretty about that.
There's energy and there.
Yeah, exactly. There's a lot of potential. And so some of the ingredients in Sun Gold, I really am excited about. Meti Attar, which is this amazing ingredient from India, which I'm sure you know about, Pranka.
Yeah.
So the proposed to have the scent of petrichor, or the scent of rain, that basically it's distilled earth, it's clay that's been dried and then co-distilled with sandalwood. And it's just has like kind of an ethereal quality to it. It's hard to pin down what it actually smells like. And to me, it adds a lot of texture.
Okay.
Really interesting too, actually, when you see how, when I do a batch of things and I'm dumping lots of an ingredient into alcohol, it's really fun to watch visually how the ingredient kind of swirls and plays in the alcohol. And it often visually is very similar to the way it acts sensually. So for me, the Meti Attar is kind of creates a velveteen experience in the scent. And visually you see it's like a velvet reaction in the alcohol.
Cool. Yeah.
Really fun. So beautiful. It's so fun. It's fun for every sense is what I like to think about.
Yeah. Nice. And Oaxaca, like you said, is just the opposite, really.
So it was inspired by the work that I did for this company called Back Bar Project that was importing artisanal single village mezcals from Oaxaca. And I had the great honor to go and visit a lot of these palenques or places where they make mezcal. And gosh, there's not a more spiritual spirit that is created that I know of on this earth. Mezcal is a part of the life of these villages. It's the first thing that touches a baby's lips. It's the last thing to touch your lips when you die. It's at your wedding. It's at saints' days. It's a part of ritual life. And it's a real connection between earth and spirit. It's made from wild and cultivated agaves. But some of the wild agave that they use is, you know, 25, 30 years old. So this individual plant has taken a generation to grow and reach maturity. And then it's harvested and with respect and reverence and crafted into this spirit that is smoky and fruity and strange and unique to each individual distiller and each individual village. And it's just a really special thing. It left such an impression on me that I had to capture it in perfume. So that's the backstory with Oaxaca. And it's got notes of smoke and tuberose and chocolate and some spices and galangal for cinnamon notes. And yeah, it's just complex and spicy and sexy and dark and mysterious. And love it.
It's yummy. It's beautiful.
It's the perfume that people smell, and especially perfume people, and they go, I've never smelled anything like this in a perfume. Like, this is very strange. But they love it.
They're really cool. And then you also did a collab with Death & Co. And I love these four scents so much. To me, I've told you, I love the Washington, D.C. one especially. But actually, you have four scents, New York, Denver, Los Angeles, and Washington, D.C. And you did this collab with the bar Death & Co., right?
You know, after I started the perfume business and I'd been out of the booze world for a while, and I kind of was like, why did I do that for so long? You know, when you look back on something you've done in your life, you're like, why was I doing that for so long when I'm doing this thing now? So yeah, my friend reached out to them and said, well, you know, do you want to do a perfume with Jackie? And they were like, yes, that sounds amazing. And I was like, okay, that's why I was in this industry for 10 years, was to do this thing. And so they have bars. Their original location is in New York City. They've opened one in Los Angeles, one in Denver, and their newest one is in Washington, D.C. And the idea behind the fragrances was to create something that was inspired by the essence of the Death & Co. brand, like what it's like to be inside one of their bars, which is always like dark and sexy and kind of mysterious and fun and nightlife, but also very, very cocktail specific. You know, these are James Beard award-winning cocktail people and very serious about drinks and make amazing drinks.
How did you approach making the perfumes?
So I sent them like a questionnaire. There were funny sort of like irreverent questions about like, if Death & Co. was a color, what would it be?
Yeah.
And if you had a theme song, what would it be? And sort of flavor, texture, inspirations from all senses. But really what we decided on was, well, you have this iconic identity as a brand, Death & Co., right? And but you're taking it to these different cities and you're using local ingredients and you're using local talent. And so the idea was to think about the location of Death & Co., but keep the identity in each perfume. So the first one I made was New York. Mm-hmm. And because it's their flagship location and everything kind of evolves from that location. And then I translated that into the Los Angeles and Denver versions. And I kept some of the same ingredients from New York, Los Angeles, and Denver. So they all smell very different,
I
think.
They do.
But they all have coffee and cardamom and saffron, sweet incense. So there's a bunch of similar ingredients, but taken in very different directions. And so that was really fun.
Ooh. By the way, I wore the Los Angeles and made the cocktail.
You did? That's so great. Yeah, Tyson Bueller, who works for Death & Co., came up with some cocktails inspired by the perfumes, which I haven't even tasted yet. I should make the cocktails at home. But yeah, what did you think? How were they together?
I love it. It works. Honestly, I've only done that one. I have yet to do the others, so I will do that. And on the Death & Co. website, which I can provide a link to in the show notes, people can try it out too. They can get your sample of all four fragrances and then make the cocktails to go with it. And it's really fun. You get to see the creative synergy.
Yeah, for sure. And it's nice too, because historically, I mean, one of the other big reasons that I was kind of anti-perfume for a long time was that working in hospitality, it's actually a really big no-no to wear perfume or fragrance, because you don't want what you're wearing to interrupt the experience of the diner. You know, I worked in fine dining, and so that was a very taboo to wear fragrance, personal fragrance. And the cool thing about, again, natural perfume is that it works in those environments because it doesn't compete. Like, it doesn't overwhelm. It complements. It really is a nice accessory to the experience. So you don't have to be self-conscious of offending the chef if you're wearing a natural perfume, because it just, it works in that way, which is really cool.
And to be clear, you're not wearing a cocktail. You know, like, you didn't create these fragrances to smell like a cocktail. You're definitely take the nuance of the cocktail ingredients, but it is specifically a perfume, which is really nice. It's not like you smell like an alcoholic who's had too many drinks or something. You know what I mean? Like, if anybody's wondering, like, what is this? Just trying to take alcohol totally. And applying it on your skin and you smell like somebody who's been in a bar too long, yeah, but it's not that at all.
Yeah, that's funny. But yeah, it was really cool. Actually, the Los Angeles was nominated last year for an Institute for Art and Olfaction Award for 2023. So that was a real big surprise and a great honor to be recognized in that way. I mean,
congratulations. Yeah, you deserve
it. Thank you. It was super fun. Awesome.
So I always like to ask my guests three questions at the end, and I did share those with you. So I can't wait to hear who Jackie Brenner is. So I want to know, what's your favorite smell right now? Any smell in the whole wide world?
Well, right now in this moment, it's very seasonal because my neighbor Stephanie's freesias are in bloom. And gosh, they smell amazing. You can smell it from halfway down the street. And it's just this lovely sort of peppery white floral smell that is, it's fleeting. It's just a very short window for the freesia. And yeah, it's heaven.
Sounds perfect. Do you have a favorite scent memory that you can share?
You know, it's interesting. I really liked the way that my skin smelled after a day at the beach. The sort of like salty, oceanic sweat, sunscreen, fried skin a little bit, you know, there's just like this combination of elements that would lead to that specific smell. But yeah, I can kind of just smell it in my mind right now. Yes, I love that about smell and flavor, is that you can think about something and you can actually experience it.
All right, well then here's the last question for you. What would you say are five smells that best describe you?
Five smells that best describe me. I was thinking of green tea because I have matcha every morning, and that's a subtle one, but I love it. I love the smell of green tea, and it's something I drink every day.
Yeah, it's a little earthy. I like that.
So matcha, plumeria, frangipani, I guess people call it too, which is just, I always had a plumeria behind my ear as a kid growing up, and I just love that smell. Mm-hmm. So transcendent. Lillet, which is an alcoholic ingredient. It's funny, I worked on that brand for a really long time. It's a white wine based aperitif from Bordeaux that is made with citrus peels and quinine. And yeah, I love the smell of Lillet. I love the taste of Lillet. It's one of my favorite things to drink, but also as an ingredient, it's really fun. But it kind of, I don't know, I think of my style of drink making. It's like low alcohol and wine based, and that's really kind of my jam. And I just love the way that smells. And so yeah, I can identify with that. What else? Gosh, this is hard, Frauke. I like nutmeg. I think nutmeg is a fun one because it's, yeah, I do love spices. I think spices are super fascinating because, you know, in small doses, they're really powerful, but then in large doses, they're poisonous or psychedelic. And I really dig that. Nutmeg is one of my favorites. I think there's just something really odd and kind of alien about the scent. Like I don't smell nutmeg in many other things. It's kind of a singular scent that I really enjoy.
And then I'm going to give you Mitti Utter if you like that.
Of course, that's one of my favorites. I love it so much.
There you go. Want to thank you so much for talking to me about mixology, perfumery, just creativity. I've learned a lot, and I've really enjoyed your fragrances, and I can't wait to explore mixing cocktails more, whether that's alcoholic or otherwise, you know? So just thank you for sharing your creative process.
You're so welcome. My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining me on An Aromatic Life. If you're interested in learning more about your sense of smell from all different perspectives, subscribe to the podcast and invite your friends too. And it would be so helpful if you could rate the podcast so it helps others find it too. I also invite you to check out my website, anaromaticlife.com, where I share lots of information, including my projects around the sense of smell. Until next time, remember to smell everything and have a wonderful day.